So this is for Inside Out Style.
Hi, I'm Imogen Lamport from Inside Out Style, and I am talking to Jill Chivers today about her new book, Shop Your Wardrobe, which chronicles her year without clothes shopping that she did a decade ago. And I actually realized that I joined you on your year without clothes shopping, but for a very different reason, because I didn't shop for a year between the end of 2009 and the end of 2010, because I was getting divorced and I had no money, so little money. I actually had a healthcare card, which in Australia means you earn less than $30,000, which is not, it's like poverty line. So like for me, I did not go shopping that year, but not because I chose not to, because, well, I chose not to because I wasn't prepared to go into debt for it. But you chose it for a different reason. And that's because you figured out that you had an over shopping issue. Over shopping problem. And I was really fascinated reading this of where do you think this started? Like, what was the kind of origin of it?
You know, that's so interesting to think about. I look back at early memories of shopping and style, you know, back to high school, university, first job in Sydney. And that sense of overdoing it is present in all of those experiences, never really feeling like I had enough. And certainly by the time I hit my first job in my early 20s, I moved to Sydney a week before I turned 21, still one of the most courageous things that I ever did. Didn't know anybody, didn't have a job, had temporary accommodation lined up. And, you know, once I actually got two jobs at the same time and took them both, and I had things on lay-by all over Sydney, even train stops that I just was changing trains at, I would get off and go and, you know, put things on lay-by in stores. But even back at university, I can imagine, think back to when I had a little bit of excess money and I would go to the mall and I would buy something I didn't need. I remember this one little white tank top with these fake gold buttons. See, I remember this very clearly. And I remember it being something like $25, which at that stage, you know, I was... Well, I was on scholarship. I was putting fuel into my car, $5 a time. That was what I was allocating myself every week. So a $25 singlety top with these garish gold buttons really didn't qualify as being a necessary purchase. But I remember that, you know. So I feel like this sense of it never really being in perspective is something that now I've turned around and looked back at my history and held up the biggest light that I could, I see it going back into my history a long, long, long way back. You know, when I talk tongue-in-cheek, I talk about my Barbie dolls having tortured lives and extensive wardrobes. And that is meant to be a little bit funny, but it's also sort of meant to indicate an interest in these kinds of things. And, you know, just that this, I feel, in a way, has always been with me.
Yeah. And so in your family, when you were growing up, you know, as a teenager, was shopping something you did for fun with your mother?
Yes, it was. And very interestingly, I had my parents were at opposite ends of the spectrum when it came to not only spending, but how much emotional enjoyment you put into it. My father being the classical saver, still is the keeper of the keys, the tracker of the outgoings, and my mother being the spender. And my mother got a lot of enjoyment from spending. She's really ill now and really doesn't leave the house. So, but, you know, up until recent shopping trips, it's something she's always enjoyed. And in fact, they set up, you know, a bit of an arrangement between them where they became extreme versions of this, where Dad never seemed to get hardly any pleasure from spending anything and was sort of relegated to a role that did come naturally to him, but he had to fulfill even more because, you know, my mother didn't have a lot of awareness. And I think there was a little bit of deliberateness there, you know, like Dad took care of all that stuff. She didn't have to worry too much. She could just buy whatever took her fancy. And I remember her taking me shopping when I was 12 to buy my sort of first grown up wardrobe and going, you know, to the teen section versus the kids section of the department store, getting my first high heels, just little itty bitty high heels. And I remember that shopping experience, and it was hugely positive and very meaningful to my mother. And, you know, she loved all of that girly stuff. So I sort of got both. And, you know, people who know me know this about me. I could worry for Australia. I'm a worry wart. So I got a sprinkling of both elements of that. Sometimes I feel like I got the worst of both of those ways of looking at spending and saving and tracking money, and you know, to a point where there have been times in my life where I've spent money and I just immediately feel bad about it. It's been a somewhat tortured relationship with shopping, but also one of the features of it up until 10 years ago was obliviousness, really no awareness about what my shopping was, why I was doing it, how it was influenced by upbringing, any of these kinds of things. I would have had no idea. And I still feel like I'm discovering things about it. I may never get to the end of the road when it comes to, you know, where all of this came from and, you know, where I'm heading to. Well, I have a clearer sense of where I'm heading to, but you know, it's there's some complexity and multi-layeredness to it.
So it wasn't like one day you woke up and had massive credit card debt and there was the debt collector at the door. You know, it wasn't like you had that sort of moment that made you stop and pause to go, this is an issue. This is becoming a problem. This is no longer just fun.
Yeah.
You know, we can spend many years going, this is fun. You'd started to feel bad about, you know, shopping at certain times. But there was a point where you just went, I've got to stop.
And look, for some people it is financial, you know, they are in huge credit card debt. They feel they may never get out of it. You know, I've had women doing my programs who've said, I may never clear the credit card debt. So everything they own doesn't actually belong to them. And that was not true for me. And why that's important is because if that's the only measure you're looking for as to whether your shopping is healthy and happy, they're the two terms that I use, to shorthand for conscious shopping, that may not give you the full picture. Because for me, I was able to afford, as in not buy on credit, all the things that I owned, but I just had too much. I just had more days of the year than I had outfits. You know, I couldn't wear everything. And then I was already buying duplicates, but I had a key moment where I was about to buy a duplicate of a leopard print trench coat. This is the story that, I've been telling for 10 years. And it really was a road to Damascus moment for me. It really was, what on earth could I be thinking to buy a fourth leopard print trench coat? And that slammed into me like a runaway train. And that really was my turning point moment.
Yeah, which is, it's interesting how, you know, something, it's quite a simple, it was not unlike many other shopping experiences, but that was kind of the, maybe because you live in Queensland and trench coats really aren't everyday wear, but maybe that
no.
was
I mean, there are some winters that go by that I hadn't worn all three of the ones that I had. So, you know, this is an interesting thing about flashes of insight and where they come from. And sometimes we can track them down and other times we just recognize that they're there. And I'm just so grateful that I had that moment and I was not able to escape from it. And gee, I really tried to escape from it. I did not seek out this awareness. And, you know, we talk sometimes in our programs about blind spots. And I think I had a huge blind spot around this. And, you know, it was like I got down on one knee and peeked through the keyhole into a room. That's about the level of aperture that I had, very, very small, but it was enough for me to say, okay, maybe I need to open this door. And of course, a lot of what accompanied this was this sense of absolute terrifying fear about what I would discover, what it was about. There were lots of moments when I was going on blind faith that I was heading in the right direction, but it was a very uncomfortable space to be in.
And so you decided not to shop for clothes, accessories in this period, which of course you're still going to the supermarket, you still have to shop. And unlike giving up many other addictions, apart from food, a food addiction, shopping's, we still have to shop. But as you talk about in the book, like, it's that thing is like, you could take me at an auto parts store. I have no interest in shopping. Like,
that's right.
You know, like there's many stores. And it's one of those things that I find quite interesting when we talk about the statistics of who likes shopping and who doesn't. And that some women like, and it's very interesting that there are some people who just don't enjoy shopping at all.
Yeah.
For anything, it doesn't matter what it is, it's not an enjoyment. Then there is but usually I notice that people have an enjoyment for shopping for something or other.
Yes. So
for, you know, your husband, the auto parts store is probably like a mecca.
Oh, so interesting.
For my ex-husband, oh my gosh, he could spend hours in like the CD store. Like, right. I mean, hours, and oh, kind of save me. You know, like we all have our own things versus I could happily, you know, but I can't spend, you know, like I hit a point where I go, that's it, and I've had enough of anything. Yeah. But we all have, and I'll notice that there's some people, they're interior decorating. Like they're like, no matter what it is, that often it's, I don't enjoy shopping for clothes, but I enjoy shopping for something else. Yeah. You know, so it's not shopping per se. And this is where it's hard because you have to pull apart, is it the act of shopping or what is it, or is it about that certain subset of shopping that makes it more enjoyable? And I noticed in the book, so you had a couple of shopping experiences during that 12 months, which were, you know, there was one where you bought a skirt.
Yes, I fell off the wagon.
Fell off the wagon. And then there was another where you bought some napkins, and you bought a lot of napkins.
I bought 12 packets. I bought 12 packets. In Philadelphia.
Yeah, not in Australia. Like 12 packets at home, but like you're going 12 packets enough, it's a lot of napkins.
It is.
But the thing that really struck me was this massive self-flagellation that you went through. This is where I went, reading it, I just was like, it was like there was an awful lot of like, I have to lash myself with the seven-tailed whip or whatever it's called, you know, or falling off the wagon and buying napkins, which weren't even in your clothing accessories. So really, that was something you could have bought without actually having any, because it was outside of clothing and accessories.
Yeah.
And I found it actually quite disturbing, to tell you the truth, about how poorly you treat yourself or had treated yourself around the kind of shopping, but also just the, you're a human and everybody has flaws and, you know.
Yeah.
You didn't murder someone.
And that's a really good point. And that's really good feedback for me, actually. Certainly that was one of the things out of my year was I wanted to treat myself better. I wanted to be kinder to myself. And I think because so much of what was driving this year was emotional, there was a practical element. I wanted to wear more of what I had. I wanted to stop the incoming. But what I learned was that the emotional aspect was really the lion's share of what I was trying to have some understanding about. So the skirt incident, which happened in month three, I really didn't stop too much around that. I did have a kind of, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this properly, but that didn't have as much self-flagellation as the napkins, which was much further along. And I think I had more of a handle on it. And the fact that this all happened, boom, 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 I see them, I want them, I'm taking them, now I've got them. And then this whole, oh, what have I done to myself? Because I felt my emotional journey was much more advanced than what it was. And, you know, so, and I think too, when you have been a person who is highly, highly self-critical, and I've met a lot of women who experience a lot of self-loathing, who have overshopping issues, that is not an issue that you set down through awareness alone. Awareness is the first step. You can't go anywhere without it, but it doesn't take you to the other side of self-love just because you recognize that you've been, you know, hurting on yourself all of this time. That is a process. I'm still working on that today. You know, I will have conversations with my husband where he will just say, just be nicer to yourself. If, you know, and one of the things that I used to say, if I was my friend and I was treating myself this way, what kind of a friend would I be? And certainly I was a terrible friend to myself during a lot of that period. And so that is the emotional content, the emotional tapestry. And I think it's also one of the reasons why the book has reached so many people who overshop. And I've received so many emails from people saying, I could resonate with this so, so, so much, because that can be the internal experience that you have. Now, everyone's journey is different, but it can be tortured, absolutely tortured. But you raise a good point, which is, and I say this to people who are thinking of, you know, either doing my program or doing a hiatus of any sort, is be aware that not everybody is equipped to be able to be with you through some of those dark nights of the soul. It can be, as the word you used was disturbing, it can be really, really hard for others to witness this, partly because they can often have no awareness that this is even happening. So this sort of launches out of nowhere, it can seem like, and then the content of it can be extremely difficult for others to witness.
Yeah, it's you know, it shows it's not about the shopping per se, really, is it?
No, shopping is not just shopping.
No. In fact, you know, like, I mean, you had, it's not like you were an out of control, like you've got the credit card, you've got the debt collectors, your house is about to repossess. There's so much about this is about the emotions. And, you know, in many ways that the shopping was just a, like, or the feeling the need to shop was a cover up for emotional damage.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the books I reference in my book is To Buy or Not to Buy by Dr. April Lane Benson, who literally wrote the book on overshopping. She did her PhD on it and then turned it into a book. And she has 11 reasons why we overshop. And one of them is to mask or repair, negative feelings, feelings of loneliness or being not enough or whatever it is. And of course, when I first started, I thought that a lot of my shopping was celebratory. You know, I did it to make me feel good after doing, you know, something that was a challenge. And whilst that was true, that was not the entire picture. And I was reading through one of my 10 years down the road parts to the book, and I used the phrase in reference to duplicate buying, one is not enough, referring to one item of clothing or whatever it is not enough. And then I read it another way, one referring to the self, one is not enough. And that really is at the heart of a lot of overshopping, certainly for me, this feeling of not being enough. And so you shop and you shop and you shop to fill yourself up. And of course, there are not enough black boots in the world to fill you up. There are not enough leopard print trench coats in the world to fill you up. They just, you know, they do not exist. There's just not enough of them.
Yeah. And I think to me, you can go, it's the same thing for food or like whatever it is. Like I can't eat enough to fill up that hole. I can't drink enough. Like it's a hole. And I think that's probably the basis of all addictions, is that that there's some sort of hole that, you know, we have, that psychic hole that, you know, wants us to fill it with something. You could have, you know, potentially had a lot of screws and bolts that you'd be buying if that had been your preferred shopping.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But yeah, so are there any other kind of, what are the, I know you've got the April Lane Benson's like 11 tips, like what, or like signs that you may be an overshopper? I don't know if you know them off the top of your head. You probably do.
Well, I mean, there are many elements to what can clue you into whether you're an overshopper. I talk about the three phases of shopping, and you can pick up at any one of those three phases how healthy and happy your shopping is. And the first one is before you go shopping. What is driving your shopping? What is prompting your shopping? Even that question alone can be enlightening and life-changing, to even recognize something is preceding your shopping. Now, people whose relationship is healthy and happy to shopping, it's about a need. It's about buying a specific thing that they already know they have a place for, a physical place, a psychological place, an emotional place. So there is not all these spiky emotions that precede shopping. People whose relationship to shopping is unhealthy and unhappy is often littered with this emotional spikiness. They're bored, they're lonely, they need something to provoke their senses, they need something to make themselves feel better, they want to heal an emotion that has caused them harm or hurt. And so this preceding shopping thing is often full, but it's often unconscious as well. So you just find yourself at the mall buying stuff without recognizing it. So that's the before piece, tuning into it. What is shopping fulfilling for me? I have a blog post, The Six Human Needs, and where shopping fits into them. That can be one lens that you can look at. You know, where is my shopping coming from? Then the during part of shopping, which is, of course, where a lot of attention is placed on, is just, you know, what I do when I'm shopping and what kind of an experience that is like, which is why you should never go shopping when you're bored or hungry or tired or emotionally charged in any way, because people who overshop, they're shopping, I call it, with your brain on neutral, or sometimes just off. It's just off. There is no sense of direction, purpose, outcome, intentionality. None of that is going on. And it can be frenetic, or the pace can be slower, but there's just not a lot of awareness of what's going on. And of course, after is a really big one. It's huge, because for over shoppers, they are fraught with emotions of shame, guilt. They feel greedy. This is where a lot of returning goes on. And this is, of course, the equivalent of the bulimic, who eats and then throws up. Mm. And people who have a healthy and happy relationship to shopping are not fraught with all of these emotions that dog them and take all the joy out of whatever it is that they've purchased, because their before was healthy and happy, their during was healthy and happy, and so they've come out the other end and it all makes sense on every level. And so when you put that lens on it, so for me, I still sometimes have moments where my emotional graph is spiked and I think shopping. But now I have trained myself to recognize I am in a preceding shopping moment. What is this about? What other ways can I use to get clarity or soothe myself or whatever it is that I actually need? Because I know that not only will shopping not meet that need, it will make me feel worse, because you get into that vicious cycle of I feel bad, I shop, I feel worse. And if you never get out of that cycle, this is where you can end up doing real damage to yourself.
And that's really interesting, how when you were young, you know, I shop, but you didn't feel bad. And then at some point down the track, you started feeling these negative emotions started coming up. Do you remember any kind of point where that started to happen? If there was something that kind of, you know, from the having it, you know, lay-by all over town to to going, you know, like this is not working anymore.
You know, the 10-year moment was really significant for me, because I had had a particular work situation going on where I was very busy with a massive corporate client. And even though I was over shopping, I wasn't giving it too much attention because I was so busy with work. And then I had that contract actually removed from me, as did every other service provider to that organization. They had a new head of people come in, and he put a halt to everything. That actually caused me enormous disruption on many levels. A lot of my professional identity was tied up with that program. It was highly creative. It was highly successful, the most successful program that organization has ever had. And, you know, even now you can hear with me just saying that how much attachment I had to it, as well as financial. And so that really catapulted me into a new working space. But my shopping didn't really stop. It changed complexion in a way. And I had probably that period of about a year where I was in transition, but I wasn't as aware of. I was just reacting to this transition. And it was really that moment. I was a volunteer member for a professional organization, so my travel was being paid for, but I was still shopping as though I was getting the big bucks at the end of every trip. And of course, I wasn't getting the big bucks of every trip. I was just getting the undying love of our members. And that's very hard to take to a store and pay for goods with. And so,
well,
you know,
don't take undying love.
They don't. You can't get a card for it. I know, you can't get a card for it. And so it was almost like I sort of got a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 punch. Like, you know, you actually don't have the funds for this. You know, fortunately, there are other sources of income, but those are exhaustible. And, you know, you don't have that same level of income, and you have far too much, and you can't wear everything that you're wearing, and you're no longer doing that same kind of work. So why are you even thinking of buying another blazer when you already have so more blazers than what you can wear for the work that you were doing before. Why would you put another blazer into the mix? I was doing a lot more writing at home and all that kind of stuff. Environments in which blazers were not required.
No, so quite an amalgamation of things that kind of then brought up. It was like.
Yeah.
And one of the things you bring up in the book is all about the Gruen transfer and all about how shops and malls in particular are built to keep us in their shop, make us shop longer. You talk about how the average shopping trip used to be 20 minutes. As soon as they build a mall, it went three times that amount to 60 minutes. But also too, and I've experienced this once, I was in Adelaide when I used to be a publicist at Penguin Books, I was in the supermarket. I was probably walked in to buy maybe, tampons or something. Like it was some small thing. It was just like, you go to the supermarket to get, like, I didn't need to, I wasn't doing a weekly shop. I was in a city that, I was staying in a hotel, but I, for some reason or other, I had to go into a supermarket. I walked into this supermarket. And I remember I walked through the dog food aisle and I noticed dog food was on sale and I picked some up and I was seriously walking this dog food to the cash register with whatever it else that I actually had got that I needed. And I remember going, my dog's at home in Melbourne. Why have I got this dog food? I'm not about to carry this back in my suitcase. Like, this is crazy. They've done something to me. Made me pick up the dog food.
They have done something to you. Yes, they have.
It's just like, oh God, I put the dog food down and like, I've got to get out of here.
yeah, exactly. I have had the enormous pleasure of meeting somebody who studied retail design and how to put shopping centres together. And of course, Victor Gruen was the first person who turned shopping centres from being extroverted, outward facing, to being introverted, inward facing. And the idea of putting in quadrants of a mall, big stores that people would want to visit. So you had to travel the length and breadth of the mall to be able to meet all of them. They're windowless. The air is pumped in. There are no clocks. The exits are hard to find. All of these things are designed to get you in, disorient you with respect to time, and therefore keep you there. Then everything else that's designed within the shopping centre is designed to entice. Everything from how merchandising is displayed to all of those little carty things that are in the middle of the store, the whole thing. And of course, now we live in a virtually cashless society. I think the relationship to casinos is almost complete. There is a reason why you cannot gamble with cash in a casino. You must use chips, and that is very specifically designed, and they're colorful and they're in really neat tactile shape. Chips are, and all of that is very, very deliberate. It's so you disconnect from your own money. And this is what we do with our little bits of plastic. We disconnect from our own money, which is why I often advocate using cash. Now, I know that that's considered a little bit old-fashioned, and now we have COVID, it's sometimes not safe. There are many elements. I appreciate that. But the whole idea is you want to reconnect to, this is your hard-earned money, and your hard-earned money came from somewhere. It came from the time invested in whatever it is you do to earn income. And so being aware of this, I'd never thought about shopping centres and the contributory role they have to how we shop and how much we shop. And I became fascinated by shopping centres.
The very worst store I've ever been in for that is Harrods in London. If you've ever walked through Harrods, you cannot find the exit. Right. There's almost no signage. And you just walk through room after room after room, which all kind of look the same but different, merchandise. Very hard to find an escalator, get up or down. Like, it is the most, it's a bit like an IKEA, but worse.
Labyrinthine.
Labyrinthine, and almost impossible to find your way out.
That's deliberate. That is absolutely deliberate.
And it is one of those things that I know whenever I walk into a new shopping centre, where did I park the car? And I always make sure I note down what shops on the left, what shops on the right. Like, I know exactly where I've parked. Then I'll go, what's the next major? I go, okay, if I head back to there, that's where I can find my exit. But you have to, I've created some strategies to make sure I can get out of the shopping centre alive.
I won't still be here at dinner time.
But it is fascinating, just this, you know, like, so, you know, we can all get, you know, you don't have to have a shopping addiction to get sucked in to, you know, the retail. I mean, it is a, it's, of course, that's how, you know, these businesses stay alive, is by us shopping.
That's right. These cathedrals of commerce, so they're meant to get us all in. But for the overshopper, it is particularly challenging because the awareness dial is often set very, very low. And there's all of these other things prompting the shopping beyond actual need or even want sometimes. I've met many overshoppers who bring home things they thought they wanted. In fact, they didn't think they could live without. And then within a short period of time, they can't imagine what they were thinking. They don't even want it, let alone need it. And so you have all of this feeding into what is driving an over shopper's behavior. So adding more fuel to the fire, which is where all of that haul shopping can end up happening for the over shopper, who then ends up feeling utterly miserable at the end of the experience and is poorer on every single level as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they are places to heighten your awareness of for everybody. I think that that's healthy for everybody, but particularly if you have a tendency to overshop, it's essential. Mm-hmm. I do time limiting. I mean, I never go to those kinds of shopping centres anymore. You know, I went once recently. I did a video for the book launch. I went with a girlfriend who wanted to go to T2, big tea store here in Australia, who happens to be in our biggest local shopping centre. But apart from that, I never go to those shopping centres anymore. I actually find them soulless and difficult. And mm-hmm. But, you know, whatever shopping I do, I always put strategies around it. Certainly if I went to one of those kinds of shopping centres, one of the things you can just do is simple. It's just time. I'm going to limit the amount of time that I spend here. When my alarm goes off in 2 hours, I am leaving. I'm going straight from wherever I am standing to the closest exit or the exit nearest my vehicle, and I'm leaving.
And I think too, it's also being aware if you have people who enable your overshopping as well.
Yes, partners in crime.
Yeah, that it, you want to make sure that you're shopping with people you trust who are not going to do that for you. So I imagine you're very careful now about anybody you shop with.
Yeah, I do. I had one partner in crime, still a friend that I have, and somebody who would often and still will often, not that we go shopping much together, but we did recently, well, in the last year, and still encouraging me to buy. So even just an encouraging word, hey, isn't this neat? No matter what it is, it could be, you know, a leopard print wine glass, it you know, could be pair of riding boots, whatever it is, will say, oh, you should grab that. And often using that kind of language, you know, highly charged language. So now I have an awareness and I have a great deal of love for this person. And so I just have to put up a whole stack of, you know, I think of them as sort of barriers, really, to really deflect those kinds of comments, because I'm very susceptible to that kind of thing. Oh, that's fantastic. That would look so great on you. I now know how susceptible I am to those kinds of complimentary remarks. And this is where raising your level of self-awareness is so very, very helpful, because I know I just get sucked in by being told I look good in something. Yeah. And so I need to be able to lessen the impact of that and raise the volume of my own voice, which is, what do I really need? And what do I really want? And, you know, and then I have others around me who are really great. And sometimes, you know, I will say to whomever I'm with, you know, this is just an art gallery day. That's just a term I use to say this is an appreciation day. There's no buying going on today. So those things can be really helpful for me. I've had women join my program who say, you're the only person in the world who knows this about me. I can't tell anybody in my space about this. People either laugh about it or think it's a bit of a joke. You know, overshopping is called the smiled upon addiction for a reason. It's not taken as seriously as other process addictions like drug and alcohol addiction or gambling or problems with food. And so it can be a very lonely and isolating space to be.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's important too, to go, if you do have this sort of problem, it's like, be wary of if you've got someone who is feeding it. And also I think this is where to getting that style education is so useful, because you can then actually determine, like, that's not my shape. Just because it's leopard print doesn't mean it's for me. I'm saying this is Jill, not me.
Yes.
You know. You know, and even like, you know, you talk about in the book, like it wasn't even a nice leopard print. Like you bought a pair of, you know, it weren't even a nice leopard print. You know, and that's the thing is, it's like, I like, you know, certain patterns, but I don't like every one of them. Just, yeah. You know, it's that sort of thing to be aware of. And also having that, and I think this is where style education is so useful.
Oh, yeah.
And I've noticed that the more I know, the less I buy.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the things people comment to me often is like, I go out shopping and I come home with empty handed. I'm going, fantastic. That means you're empowered.
Yeah.
You know, that means you've been able to say no to all those marketing messages and that stuff that's going on in those stores to make you buy.
Yeah.
You've actually got that knowledge. You're actually using it, and that is fantastic. That makes me so proud.
And it demonstrates your ability to discern. Yeah. You have a discerning eye, and you can do it in the moment. And this is what's so critical. It's not an after the fact thing. No. Now, some people do, they will deliberately buy more than what they need. They know this because they need that being at home, playing around. They can't stand there in a store and see all the 10 items at home that this thing is going to go with. They actually need to do it. I appreciate that that happens for a lot of people. But that capacity to discern, to have that assessing, deciding function really work for you at its highest operating value, that is incredibly valuable.
Yeah. So it's such a useful thing. And I think this is where, yeah, style education is a huge thing to help you get that. And then also too, if you do bring things home, try them on, make sure they still do work and they're out of that emotionally charged environment. Yeah. So it can allow you, is it really me? Or was the sales assistant, because, you know, like, was the sales assistant really friendly and so, or very helpful, and I felt I had to buy something because she was being nice. Many people who have this as an issue.
Yes.
Or, you know, the flattery thing, and I know you talk in the book about she said you looked great and something, and we've all had the same thing. I remember going shopping with a friend and we were in this store and the clothes were a bit weird, like they were kind of crumpled up and, like, you know, everything was tied in a knot. And I'm going, well, it doesn't look like on. So yeah. Like, go and put it on. And she's going, I can't come out of the change room. It's so horrendous. No, and I fling open the, and of course, yeah, like, it's horrendous. And the sales assistant is standing behind me going, oh, you look marvelous. And it's like, I said, on what planet? Like, this is horrible. Like,
are you looking at the same thing I'm looking at?
Yeah, it's like you're just looking at a ding, ding, ding sale. I'm looking at, like, and this is the thing, is it can be hard if you're, you know, if there are certain things, you know.
To be your own style best friend, not just your best friend altogether, but your own style best friend. And you're absolutely right that style education is huge. Fundamentals for me are colour. What colours suit me? And added to that, what colours do I love?
Yeah.
And they are related to one another. What silhouettes suit me? What fabrics suit me? What kind of construction? I've told this story a few times, but it's such a good one. You and I going shopping and I picked up a Boo Radley, I don't even know what it was. Was it a tunic? Was it a vest? Was it a dress? I don't even know.
It was a garment.
It was a garment. And you said to me, it's too creative in and of itself. So I consider myself quite a creative dresser, but I've defined that in a particular way. And, you know, your very insightful observation was the garment itself is too eclectic or too creative or too avant-garde within itself. And you're absolutely right. And I know this because a friend of mine had given me another Boo Radley. Fabulous label, by the way, had given me a Boo Radley thing that I still didn't know what it was, and I'd never been able to wear it. I still don't know what it was. Was it a vest or a tunic? I don't know. And but you know, still thinking, hey, maybe I can make this work, which is another thing. The capacity to rationalize is endless. And this is great information to have. Signature style, knowing what it is, which can also be a trap for me because, as I illustrated in the book, buying everything leopard print just because it's leopard print. You know, you have to turn on your discerning capability, but get that style education. It is a priceless, absolutely priceless. Whatever you pay for it, it will return to you over and over and over and over again, not just in saved money, but in increased confidence. I just don't know how anybody creates any kind of working wardrobe without it.
Yeah, because, you know, too, like, when you've got your color palette, 3/4 of the stuff out there is not for you. Like, it's so easy to stop even looking at it. Like,
absolutely.
All that sort of stuff. You do not get overwhelmed in the same way is, you know, and that's what they're there to do, is kind of overwhelm you, make you just walk out with stuff, part with your cash.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And that the point about salespeople is incredibly important, because our relationship with salespeople, it can be brief, but it can be complex. And it might just be somebody who's being friendly to us, or it might be someone who's a little bit bossy, who is somehow in a gestalt way feeding into an influential person from our past, and we haven't made this connection and we want to please them in some way, not because they're being friendly to us, but we kind of like they've set a high bar, or you know, we want to, you know, make them proud of us. And this sounds bizarro, but these are the kinds of dynamics that can happen, particularly if you don't have a great deal of confidence in your own style, or you're in a transition period. This is also when a lot of women are vulnerable. They're changing, you know, jobs or geographies, or relationships have changed, or they're empty nesting, even going through menopause. Any number of life transitions can be a place where you need to pivot with your style. And if you don't have enough sort of solid foundational style knowledge and confidence, you can be highly susceptible to the opinions of others. And if that somebody is earning a commission from you buying something, then to me, you need to factor that into their opinion, which may or may not be actually in your best interest from a style perspective.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's always important to remember is they don't know you. They don't know what your style is. You know, like there's so much that goes into it. And that's all stuff, of course, we have discussed many times in various forms. But so I want to remind you that now Jill's book is available on Amazon. So you can go and grab it there and read it. Now, I actually, lucky enough, I got to print mine out, but they're all digital. But yes, so do go and grab your copy of Shop Your Wardrobe on Amazon by Jill Chivers right now.